everyone, thank you very much for finding a way to funnel yourselves into this room. I don't think it ever had that many people. So please remember to breathe. I'm sorry to have had to ask the people sitting at the back to just open the doors a bit. I know that it gets a bit chilly, but I don't want mass faintation. At least not before you had a chance to welcome Professor Kohler. I'm Jane Bennett, and I work at the African Gender Institute. The African Gender Institute runs a series of talks, sometimes installations, sometimes movies, sometimes discussions that we call Walking the Talk. We have them once every 2 weeks, and the aim behind it is to try and open up questions about what it means to be living as people who take gender and sexuality extremely seriously within African contexts, but not necessarily within only academic spaces. We care about those spaces, we care about writing, we care about ideas, but I think what we care most about is that in some sense, no matter who we are, we walk our talk. And it's my great privilege to welcome Professor Phuma Kohler here to the African Gender Institute. She's going to be, I'm moving quite fast. Again, the faintation problem is on my mind. She's going to be talking with us for about 40, 45 minutes. We certainly hope that there'll be a bit of a chance for a conversation afterwards. She's probably well known to many of you. Not only is she a prolific writer within academic circles, her most recent book is called What's Slavery to Me? Post-Colonial Slavery Memory in Post-Apartheid South Africa. It's an amazing book. I utterly recommend it. I'm not sure why it isn't on everybody's book purses, but it certainly will be or should be after tonight. And she's written in a number of different places that are in academic journals, are in book collections, but, you know, that's not the only reason she's here tonight. One of the main reasons she's here tonight is because of the way in which, as long as I've known her, she has committed herself to public voice. She has been willing to speak her mind, always an informed, always a smart, always a well-networked mind about some of the most difficult questions that we face in South Africa. She's yes on Facebook, yes in blogs. You can find her in many places that are about continuing to shape the possibility of what I would call discursive hope, discursive rebellion, discursive presence within our country. What she's going to be talking about tonight goes to a fairly extraordinary reality, which is that in the last 6 months, we've seen people at ministerial and parliamentarian level making an enormous fuss about gender-based violence. Oh Lord, how did that happen? Why did it happen? What does it mean? How did those of us who've been, and many of you are in this room, who've been working against gender-based violence through different lenses and different strategies for as long as we've known how to breathe, how do we engage at this moment in 2013 with these discourses on gender-based violence? Her talk is called 2013, A Bad Year for Gender Struggle, Gender-Based Violence, and Feministing Differently. From the poll.
Things, so I'm very happy to be here. I have a very just presented talking the walk before. Is it walking the talk or talking the walk?
Talking the walk.
Or is it both? Talking the walk. Talking the walk before. So thank you, Jane Bennett, and the AGI and the GEU for hosting me, for asking me and for hosting me. It's always a joyfully nourishing experience to gather and converse with other feminists for men. Even when we fight, as we sometimes do, and even when we disagree, as we must, I agree with many African feminists who have spoken of the joy we find in communion, even when we are talking about difficult, painful, and enraging topics. So I want to start my talk today with both aspects of my relationship to feminist selfhood and community in mind, location work in mind. So with that joyful discovery, love, political love, but also with the rage that I, you know, that I feel often. I want to start by sharing a few stories with you. Can the people over here hear? I'm very loud, so I'm sure you can, but sorry. Maybe I should stand in the room. I'm going to be very self-conscious. Okay, fine. For me, not the food. I want to start by sharing a few stories with you as part of my making sense of what is going on in South Africa, in Southern Africa, and the world in relation to gender-based violence, and more specifically, violence against women. My first story is a story about feminist Lebopule, who tells a story about walking into a shop in the Johannesburg CBD where a young man verbally harasses a young woman who walks in after him. He tries to get her attention, goads her, and she ignores him by walking away from him, looking away from him, and not responding to his words. He persists, and the woman eventually lets him know that she's not interested in talking to him, and he should leave her alone. She tells him, go away. He says, that is why we rape you. An enraged Lebopule intervenes, interrogates the man, who doesn't quite know what hit him. First asking him, how is that why you rape women? What do you mean that is why we rape you? How do you rape women? How many women have you raped? As increasingly the rest of the shop watches in slight shock at the crazy feminist, Lebopule, who will not let it go like she should, making the young man uncomfortable like she shouldn't, the shopkeepers keep quiet. The harassed young woman turns around and tries to console Pule, telling her, "Don't get yourself so worked up, my sister. We're used to these dogs speaking to us like this. They are rubbish. Don't worry so much. Don't get yourself so worked up." That's my first story. The second story I would have told, but I'm in Cape Town, so I'm not going to tell it in the long version. Given that I'm in Cape Town, I'm not going to tell you the story of how young Anine Boysen's terrorization, the breaking of her body, and the cutting short of her life, because I know we all continue to think about her, and perhaps more so in Cape Town than, you know, anywhere else. But you will remember that in the midst of all the lit candles, the marches, the Fridays in black and the Fridays in white, and other public ways in which many, many people insisted on remembering her and speaking that memory, there was also something else. The politicians who slut-shamed her. I'll say a little bit about slut-shaming. Who slut-shamed her, telling her she was inappropriate and was in the wrong place. If she hadn't been in such a wrong place, if these young women acted a little bit more appropriately, this kind of thing wouldn't happen as much as it does. If she wasn't at a drinking place. The journalists who said it was her mother's fault. What kind of mother lets her teenage daughter go out and about in the middle of the night? It's your fault. It's the mother's fault that the daughter got raped. The writers in various public forums who said it was because that is just how poor black men behave. So really, she should have known. And what are we going to do? We can't get rid of all the poor black men. So that bizarre focus on the layers of supposed responsibility that everybody should have taken. Her parents, her dead parents, her foster parents, who let her go out at night and loved her, as we were told, so imperfectly that the only picture of her that was circulated initially was her ID photo. This was an unloved child. How dare these parents? They can't even produce a proper picture. A proper picture. And loved people have many photographs, we were told. Aneen was also blamed, of course. She should not have gone out at night. What's wrong with the kind of community that allows this to happen? The business owners of the premises from which she was taken, the father who did not protect her adequately, everybody but the men who tormented, terrorized, raped, slaughtered, and killed her. My third story. A few weeks ago, maybe 2 weeks ago, 2 3 weeks ago, the man who fascinates the South African media to no end, for reasons I can't completely understand, Kenny Kunene. Admitted on a national radio station that he has multiple sexual encounters with an infinite number of women of different ages and classes as a matter of course. Asked about whether his personal wealth, the exact size of which remains unclear and uncontested, unclear and contested further, fueling the bizarre. I mean, part of the kind of fascination, is he really as rich as he says he is? I mean, I don't know why this matters so much. Or isn't he? Does he have all these millions? Is he almost a billionaire? Or does he really have only 200,000 rand? So, he was asked about whether his personal wealth was key to how attractive he was. We all know the recurring cross-cultural patriarchal claim that women are attracted to men because of their wealth. He responded by pointing out how easy women are, how easy women have always been, even when he had no money, even when he was a teacher, and how he has always had such easy access to a variety of women. He added that even as a teacher, he had no trouble with young men and adult women alike, admitting to serial curative rape. In the discussion that followed on many platforms, many feminists and non-feminists alike said, well, he's hardly unique. This has happened to us when we were at school too. It happened before us and it is widespread still. The third story also does not need much telling, so I'll just reference it. It's the story of intimate femicide by an iconic young man who has overcome bodily limitation, first with the resources of his family that they could use to his advantage, and later psychological barriers to become one of the fastest, most visible athletes, and onto whom many meanings have been projected. This is who the story is supposed to be about. It's also the story of a young woman, Rita Steenkamp, whom he killed on Valentine's Day. As feminists, we are often accused, I'm sure you are, I certainly am very often, accused of killing romance for everybody else. Feminists were often accused of killing romance for others when we point to the patriarchal violence in much of the heteronormative romantic narrative. But even we were startled by the staging of Steenkamp's shooting on Valentine's Day, as well as the manner in which Pistorius has been able to, bit by bit, return to his life, socially, economically, soon athletically, in a few weeks, as though a young woman did not die through his gun. This is a story of many missed opportunities, we told. It is also the story of the Pistorians. The Pistorians, for the people who don't do Twitter, is a network of young women in many South African cities, Joburg, in Cape Town, and Durban, and other places, but also on other continents. We're told that there's a very strong Pistorian presence in Canada, and Australia, and New Zealand, and England. The Pistorians is a network of young women in African cities, South African cities, as well as on other continents, who have taken to social media to defend Oscar Pistorius against all criticism, defending him worshipping him, working in very organized ways to respond in very mean-spirited ways to the Steenkamp family, but also to anybody who does not speak in a pro-Pistorian manner about their hero. And to circulate images of the athlete with bare torso with the hashtag Oscar porn. Right? So there's much discussion about Oscar porn, too. Many feminists and non-feminists alike remind us that this is nothing new. That men kill their intimate partners every day in this country and all over the world. That men play games with the legal system and get away with it all the time. That the legal justice system is crucial to the perpetuation of all sorts of all forms of brutality. And that at the Zuma rape trial, we saw spectacularly displayed the ways in which women could be at the forefront of defending a man accused of brutality. The Pistorians are simply the electronic social media equivalent of Mumkeeser and the masses outside the courtroom who would stop at nothing until their hero is restored to his former glory or scales even greater heights, we're told. The last story I'm going to tell is a story that I really don't know how to tell with any form of coherence. So I'm going to tell it as messily as tells itself, it allows me to tell itself. It is a story of the institution where I work. Racked by accusations of sexual harassment of young women students by male academic staff. It is a story of the many responses, missed opportunities, and complicities that this process has surfaced. To know, as a feminist, that gender-based violence is everywhere, endemic, that the sexual harassment is woven into the culture of many institutions, including the one where I work, has not been incredibly helpful, sadly, to deal with the sudden awareness that a staff member, that many feminists, and this is not one person, but I'll speak, various different, that a staff member that many feminists in the academy may have considered an ally in other institutional battles is a routine sexual harasser. Nor is it incredibly useful to deal with the overly legalistic reliance my institution has chosen. Probably if I'm calling it my institution. I never call it my institution when I'm in Joburg, so I'm not sure what that is about. Nor is it incredibly useful to deal with the overly legalistic reliance my institution has chosen to deal with young women coming forward, where aspects of the same legal machinery also prevents women from laying charges. Gags, so the legal office gags women who report, as well as staff members who try to say, we should be doing this differently. Where the legal office of the institution stalls and dissuades the reporting of sexual harassment. I don't know that it is incredibly useful to help deal with the battering of the handful of women in management who have insisted on a feminist stance to sexual harassment at that institution, and have had to deal with the patriarchal trivialization by their peers, as well as a targeted campaign by groups of violent men on that campus in an attempt to label them as traitors. They work like those men who say things like, we have seen black women like you before, who are ready to sell black men out. And we know where you and your children live. They are these men. I could tell many more stories. You know many more stories. We all do. We live them. I will admit that for the first time in a very long time, I am despondent about the state of gender and violence in South Africa. Sara Chiyumbu was feeling very similarly to this when, as part of speaking about some of the incidents I've outlined and various others, she said to me in a conversation a few weeks ago, 2013 is a bad year for gender struggle. It certainly has been overwhelming. There's much to say about which cases get prominence and the kind of narratives that surround such visibility. It is not immediately clear to me whether violence against women is on the increase or not. I know that some feminists, whom I value, are saying that this is in fact the case. I'm not sure that this is, I don't disbelieve it, but I'm not entirely sure whether that is in fact what we're seeing or if we're seeing something else. What does seem clear to me is the manner in which gender-based violence, violence against women specifically, seems more brazen. Tenjoen Tinsel speaks about this relentless policing and violence as a crisis. The crisis, she argues, is the latest form of the backlash. In other words, it is a direct attempt to undo feminist work and gains. Yes, it's the usual patriarchal violence in many senses, but it is also patriarchy defending itself. It is not a coincidence that South African women who on paper are so empowered and won so many freedoms are living with the constant fear of violence when we cross the street and work everywhere. An effective backlash, as we all know, does much more than neutralize. It reverses the gains we see everywhere. I think it is a critical time for feminists who already are so stretched and strained in this part of the world. I'm no longer satisfied to speak about the backlash as a South African contradiction. And for many years I did, and sometimes I would say, I'm speaking about it as a contradiction under erasure. I'm tired of hearing my own voice on the need to come up with new feminist strategies to defend the gains we have and to move us in another feminist direction. I do agree with Ntinso that we are in a crisis. Gender-based violence discourse in South Africa is both very, very loud in important ways and I think very dangerous. The people you sit on panels with and sometimes on radio or television show studios with talking about the scourge of gender-based violence, who share their work that they do with men to help them unlearn patriarchal entitlement to women's and girls' bodies, often walk out of those rooms and try to entangle you in a conversation about how some forms of rape are understandable. Mm-hmm. By which they usually mean, in my experience, rape between lovers. Now remember, these are not the people we generally consider the monsters. These are people who dream unpatriarchal work. And you sat on this public and perform this public shared feminist communion and you walk off stage and you're entangled in this kind of bizarre hierarchization of certain kinds of violence matter, others don't matter so much. So you sort of understand that. Walk out of these rooms and trying to entangle you in a conversation about how some forms of rape are understandable between lovers, for example. But that the rest of it needs to be fought because it is brutality. I've lost count of how many times I have fought with or heard of another person fighting with a scholar of masculinities who says that men have a crisis and that feminists need to backtrack a little bit and rethink how aggressive we are. Rethink how we put good men, who are the majority of men, in uncomfortable positions. Recently, at a meeting about sexual harassment at the institution that pays me, several male colleagues bemoan the manner in which they feel unsure and under attack. One colleague said, I feel very uncomfortable when at dinner parties, people look at me and they talk about my institution as an institution ripe for sexual harassment. I feel this reflects on me. Should this, the image of the university in the attack, not be managed in a better way so that we can have our dinner parties undisturbed by the nuisance of sexual harassment at least? Didn't say the last part, I'm saying the last part. Several male colleagues bemoan the manner in which they feel unsure and under attack. They don't know whether to leave their doors open when women students come into their offices. They don't know whether to stand across the room from women students when they come into their offices. This whole thing is making them so unsure. They're worried about their careers. They don't know how to talk to women students who so often come onto them. But they don't want to tarnish their careers. This is part of the backlash. Because we are now required, in this meeting, to make them feel better about being men in the world. In ways that ensure that we stop talking about what is under this discussion, the routine violation of women because they are women on this campus. Linked to this is the dilution that we have long seen, but that is far from over, that says we may not organize, think, work in spaces that we define. First, it was the pressure to speak about gender only and never about women. Then it was the funding pressure that made working with men a condition. So you couldn't get your funding unless you worked with men and men's programs and men's programs of a certain kind. Now we are told repeatedly we may not organize as women of any kind, even selectively, strategically, temporarily. Instead, we are worn out by accusations of all sorts of fascist agendas that we are at pains to defend ourselves against. We have to say over and over and over again, no, but not all exclusion is oppressive. We need to regain the ability to organize, think, work in feminist ways as women, if we choose. However, this is much easier said than done. And let us not kid ourselves, thinking that the only people engaged in this silencing behavior designed to put feminist work on the back foot are the same people who always oppose the word feminists do. There are many surprises, and there will continue to be surprises. We can allow ourselves to be sidetracked and apologize for even saying the word women, for fear of being accused of being essentialist, or we can remember how to prioritize women's spaces again. This requires sustained thinking about how to survive economically as well, because funders can prescribe conditions. And they prescribe conditions for a reason, because they know they can. How do we build a mass feminist movement that is not only beholden to funders? I don't know. But we do need to ask ourselves this question again and again. What do these spaces that I'm saying we need to amplify, recover, and defend allow us to do that we can't do now, to do differently, that other spaces do not allow us to do? This leads me to a linked concern that I have with much of our feminist work, especially on gender-based violence. It is crucial to focus on women as survivors and victims as we do. The very feminist spaces I have historically been located in the Academy, Rape Crisis 1&9, various other places, have taught me this unequivocally. They've also taught me the importance not only of rendering the unseen visible or audible, but also the many meanings of silence, the limitations of litigation. There's no doubt that all these feminist ways of thinking about violence have been invaluable, but they also offer an opportunity to rethink our feminist work, especially when we think about the gains of such feminist work. It is a success that feminist work has made it impossible for people in this country to claim progressive politics without pledging commitment to anti-patriarchal ideas. Yet, we have not been able to move this beyond lip service in a society where visible, powerful men are routinely rewarded for being violent, with better or unaffected career trajectories, loyalties, and self-appointed armies coming to their defense. So, as in that much-cited poem by Rashila Naya, men acquire more kudos for speaking non-sexism, even feminism, in public, but they still go home or go off stage and act in misogynist ways with no real cost. There have been calls for Zuma recently to fund an inquiry on gendered violence, to speak more strongly against rape. I'm very confused by this. First I was angry, now I'm just really confused by this. What is this called, this expectation? Even creating this as a possibility do? I'm confused because many people who self-identify as feminists are also calling for the same stronger stance by number one.